David Daley's new book, Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections, is a deep dive into what he calls the 50-year Republican plot to hijack voting rights in America, its profound implications for the 2024 election, and the crucial role that Chief John Roberts has played in determining how we vote. Daley shines a light on what has long been hiding in plain sight. He connects the dots over the decades, analyzes the crucial cases, including introducing us to key players who have lingered in the shadows, calling out the bad actors, and above all, answers the urgent question of how did we get here? David Daley regularly discusses democracy and voting rights on CNN, NPR, MSNBC, and other outlets. His new book is Anti-Democratic, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Daley to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I've been listening in Western Mass for so many years. This is a real pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to look at this 50-year plot, as you refer to it, and put it into that perspective, especially in time for this election year?
Well, I think if you are concerned about the state of American democracy, you absolutely need to be concerned about the courts, because in many ways that is at the root of our nation's anti-democratic problem. I think there's a lot of people who think that we began this descent when Donald Trump began his descent on those Trump Tower escalators into the presidential campaign back in 2015. But really, this goes back much further. There is an anti-democratic faction that has really hijacked the U.S. judiciary. It's captured and corrupted the Supreme Court. The Chief Justice, when he was confirmed in 2005, he promised to call balls and strikes, right? He said he would be an umpire. He would be modest. Indeed, he's still portrayed in many ways as an institutionalist and a centrist, but he's not acted as an umpire when you take a look at these cases. He's rewritten the rule book, he's changed the game, and he's done so every time to the benefit of his team. I would say in many ways, the Chief Justice is the most successful Republican politician of his generation, that he's delivered wins on voting rights, guns, the regulatory state, campaign finance, abortion, has assumed this much muscular, larger role for the courts in our co-equal system of government. And that the crucial thing about all of these victories that Roberts and the court have provided to the GOP is that they never could have been won through the political process. If you look at poll numbers on any of these topics, this is not the direction Americans wanted to go on any of these issues. And so what I argue here and the history I try to show is that this is not an accident, that this is a deliberate five-decade strategy to capture the courts as a vehicle to really remake the nation in this way. And if you go back to Abraham Lincoln in his first inaugural, he says that the candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon the vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by the decisions of the Supreme Court, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. I think in many ways that's the situation where we find ourselves today.
You used the word deliberate a moment ago. How much of this is seeing Justice Roberts as an architect of a conscious effort to bring about these changes?
Yes. I mean, I trace this back to the early 1970s, really, into the conservative reaction to the Warren Court, which really began to expand rights of Americans and began to really restore what I think are the most crucial hallowed ideals of the Constitution, the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution that ended slavery, that it guaranteed equal protection under the law, that guaranteed everyone the right to vote, and that really extended the American dream of freedom and liberty and equality for all to everybody. And in a series of decisions on voting rights and other issues, the Warren Court began enforcing those amendments that the court, in many ways, a century earlier had begun chipping away at, and the court's own actions there in many ways led to the century of Jim Crow rule across the South, that the Voting Rights Act and the Warren Court's actions changed. And conservatives were deeply disturbed by this in many ways. There was a lawyer in Virginia, his name is Lewis Powell, and Powell wrote a famous memo for the Chamber of Commerce, and he said that conservatives and big business were being threatened by the consumer movement, they were being threatened by the environmental movement, by the civil rights movement, by the anti-war movement on campus, and that the solution was for big business to fight back. And he said the greatest opportunity to do so is in the courts. 3 months later, Lewis Powell finds himself named to the U.S. Supreme Court by President Nixon, and his memo goes on to inspire the Koch brothers and a lot of other really wealthy conservative funders and donors, Richard Mellon Scaife, the Olin Foundation, Joseph Kors. And what they do is they begin the process of building the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute and sort of some of the Republican architecture on the intellectual right. And a few years later, there's another man, a man named Michael Horowitz. And Horowitz has the key addition to what Powell comes up with. What Powell says is that the right needed to be active in the courts. What Horowitz understands is that the next piece of this is winning the hearts and minds of young conservatives and investing in law schools and the future judges. And Horowitz connects all of those funders on the right that Powell inspired to the young people who are launching the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society has become really the most important organization, perhaps in all of America right now, because that is the transmission belt and training ground for Republican lawyers and future judges. When Donald Trump in 2016 needed to prove his conservative credentials, he went to the man who essentially runs the Federalist Society now, a man named Leonard Leo, who I'm sure your listeners are well acquainted with. And he effectively said, if you bless and endorse me, I will outsource to you and to the Heritage Foundation my picks for the U.S. Supreme Court. And so Leo comes up with the list. And so this is a long-term, step-by-step, really patient process to build power in the courts. And once you have five Supreme Court justices, you can do an awful lot of things that you can't do, even if you have control of the political process. And now they have six.
When you look at Project 2025 and the reporting on that, and obviously Donald Trump's distancing from that document, and there's a lot of reporting that shows that that distancing is not as he would want us to think. But I'm curious as to how that became, you know, the manifesto really that this campaign seems to be running on. From my understanding, the Heritage Foundation has been doing this type of work for decades.
Yes, I think that's right. That is in many ways the purpose of the Heritage Foundation. And Heritage, I dig out effectively what was Heritage's project at 2000, and I quote from it significantly in this book. And what Heritage wrote back then was that on all of these issues, on guns, on abortion, on the regulatory state, on campaign finance, these decisions are going to be determined by the U.S. Supreme Court, and that the people who sit on the court are going to be the ones who make these decisions. Conservatives were able to decide who was on the court. They were able to name those justices. And we live in a very different nation than we would have otherwise. And we live in a nation that the control on these issues has been taken away from the people in the political process, and it's been handed over to a Supreme Court that is unelected, that is appointed for life, that deliberates in private, that has no accountability, that has no ethics standards. And I find that to be deeply concerning. I think regardless of whether or not we agree on the decisions that this court is handing down, and regardless of whether we like to say that we live in a democracy or we live in a republic, we should be able to agree that 9 unelected people shouldn't be able to vacuum up this much power and hold on to it for life, unaccountable above any political process, really, at all. And I think that's what we really need to come to grips with and understand and fix.
David Daley is our guest. The new book is Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. You do write a lot about John Roberts. I'm interested in the, obviously you have to put in the building blocks as to who is going to name the court. And that was a slow, laborious process, but one that obviously worked, took a long time, but it worked. But you realize that, I think in my reading of the book, you know, you're always one election away from certain people being named to the court, not being named to the court.
Yes, certainly that is correct. And I think what's interesting in many ways is as we look at this conservative supermajority on the court, that five of those 6 justices have been named by presidents that lost the popular vote. So I think that's a pretty interesting point to make as well. When you go back, you asked at the beginning why I wrote this now, and I think we are coming up on another presidential election that could well be decided in part by the U.S. Supreme Court. I know many of your listeners are probably like me, old enough to remember what happened in 2000 in Bush versus Gore,
right?
When you had about 547 votes in the state of Florida separating George Bush and Al Gore from the presidency in the state where those electors were going to be the tipping point. And 3 of the current justices on the court were lawyers for George Bush on that case, which is an interesting historical fact. But there's going to be this 6-week period after the presidential election this year, which is November 5th. And that period between the election and when the Electoral College meets in the middle of December is going to be especially fraught. We all learned last time around exactly how contentious that process can become, how many little certification processes take place along the way, how many spots there are where the process can be slowed down or gummed up or where chaos and chicanery can be introduced. And the Republican National Committee has already filed about 75 lawsuits or amicus briefs in other suits in almost 24 states. They are laying the groundwork right now for what could happen during those 6 weeks. And there's any number of scenarios one could imagine in which certification is slowed down and the election in some of those states is as close as it appears to be right now, that the U.S. Supreme Court could be asked to weigh in on these questions. And in that case, 180 million of us will have voted on November 5th, and yet you could have in the middle of December, 9 Americans, the ones on the U.S. Supreme Court, handpicked by Leonard Leo, and presidents who lost the popular vote, actually deciding.
Not in a traditional sense, but in our current environment, President Biden is a lame duck, and he is now going out and talking about reforms that are needed on the Supreme Court. I'm curious as to, I mean, there's the whole issue of can you ever get this passed, but is he highlighting the things that really need to be done to fundamentally change the courts and to a point where what you're writing about can't happen?
I'm glad we're finally having this conversation. I think there's a lot of us who have believed for some time that we need to have real national conversation about the kind of structural reform that we need to the U.S. Supreme Court. Many of us urged this conversation on President Biden back in the 2020 campaign. When he was elected, he commissioned a blue ribbon panel and sort of stuffed that report in a drawer. What has happened since then, right? This court overruled Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs decision. This court handed the president immunity for crimes committed while in office. So we're in a much more urgent place to do this kind of reform now than we were even 4 years ago. The American people really support reigning in this out-of-control court. Even a recent Fox News poll found that 78% of Americans support the idea of term limits for justices. About two-thirds of us support the idea of justices being subject to more oversight and accountability, banning extravagant gifts for them, implementing an enforceable code of conduct, holding public hearings and investigations when there is evidence of special interest, influence, and corruption. Without reforms to rein in the court, this court's right-wing majority has made it very clear that it will use its outsized power to attack voting rights, the equal application of law, and other democratic norms and policies. I would say that under the status quo, there is a fear that pro-democracy reforms could simply be overturned by a court that has consistently prioritized right-wing partisanship at the expense of Americans' rights and freedoms, but that we really, really need these new ethics laws. We really need accountability and term limits. If the court has assumed this much power over American life, I think it is only fair that we demand to know who is funding their vacations, who is funding their lavish luxury trips and lifestyle, who, as in the case of Clarence Thomas, is paying to buy his mother's home and his family's real estate, who is paying the tuition for friends of his family. This is deeply disturbing and concerning, especially when these folks have specific interests that come before the court. So I think that what President Biden is talking about is a long overdue and much needed conversation for all of us.
The name of the book, Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. So I leave you with this question. How optimistic are you that those changes and others can actually happen in a relatively realistic period of time?
I'm not as optimistic as I would like to be. I think that it's a very urgent conversation to have. And because it's so unlikely to happen anytime soon, only makes it all the more urgent that we start moving on it now. This has to be really at the top of the list of the things that we are thinking about. Because, you know, frankly, I think there's a lot of people who think that if Donald Trump loses in 2024, that perhaps the threat has passed to American democracy. And I would say that that's not at all the case, that the threat to American democracy goes far beyond Donald Trump and the results of any one election. It's these structural problems baked into the system that Republicans have really leveraged and taken full advantage of in the courts, gerrymanders in state legislatures, things like that, that represent the very real threat to an entrenched and enduring minority rule, and that if we don't fix the structural problems, we're going to be running around every single election saying it's the most important election of our lifetime, right, and democracy is on the ballot. And all of that might be true this time, but we have to fix much more than one result.
David Daley's new book, Anti-Democratic Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. The book is published by Mariner. David Daley, thank you for being on the program this morning, and thank you for the terrific book.
A pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Anti-Democratic. David Daley is the author. It's published by Mariner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.